This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Ava DuVernay has dramatized the story of the Central Park Five in the new four-part Netflix series, When They See Us, which she produced, directed, and co-wrote. The Central Park Five was the name given to five black and brown boys aged 14 to 16 who in 1989 were accused of brutally raping and nearly killing a woman who was jogging in Central Park. They became symbols of crime in New York City. Donald Trump took out full-page ads in the city's four newspapers calling for the death penalty. The five were convicted based on confessions they made shortly after they were arrested, confessions they soon after said were coerced. In 2002, the real rapist confessed, and his DNA matched the evidence found on the victim's body. He was a serial rapist who always acted alone, and he testified that the five had nothing to do with the rape. In 2002, after the five collectively served over three decades in prison, their convictions were vacated. A year later, they filed a civil lawsuit against New York City. In 2014, they collectively received a $41 million settlement. But they couldn't get back the years of their lives they'd lost in prison. Ava DuVernay also directed the film Selma, which dramatized a chapter of the civil rights movement, and 13th, a documentary about mass incarceration and its echoes of the eras of slavery and Jim Crow. Ava DuVernay, welcome back to Fresh Air. Did you know much about their story before you made this series?
What I knew as a teenager growing up in Compton. I was on the West Coast at the same time that these boys were on the East Coast in Harlem. I was all over the place. It was big news in Los Angeles. And it really was something that I focused on because these were black boys who looked like me and my friends. They were around the same age. I'm the same age as Corey Wise. And so to hear of this, you know, dastardly, despicable, kind of devastating crime that had taken place was what everyone was talking about at one point. And particularly the word wilding caught my attention because I didn't know what it was. And I wanted to know what that meant, so I called a cousin in New York and I asked what it was, and he said, "We don't know. We think they mean wilding out." And wilding out is does not mean gang raping women. Wilding out is hanging out, kind of like being free for the night, like just acting, carefree. And I always have trouble when I try to translate urban slang into into something else, but it's not a wolf pack of animal-like thugs going into the park to, you know, torture and demean and assault and rape people. That's not what wilding out means. So part of what we do in our piece is try to kind of trace and track how wilding out becomes wilding, becomes wolf pack, becomes, you know, animals, becomes, you know, a prison sentence for these five boys.
So from having talked to the five men, give us an example of one of the stories that one of them told you about why they agreed to a confession that was not true, why they agreed to implicate themselves by saying that they did things that they didn't do.
I don't know. I take issue with the word agreed. I mean, we're talking about minors. We're talking about minors who are in rooms alone with police officers who are aggressive, who have guns on their belts and badges, who were told to mind and to respect and to follow orders from. It gets under my skin when people ask why would they do that? Why would you say something you wouldn't do? That's even Linda Fairstein. Why? Well, they said it, they did it. And it strips away the real dynamics of that room, which is what I try to show in the piece. You know how easily a child can be manipulated. You know how easily a child can be made to be afraid. And these authority figures did that to these boys. And so, you know, the answer to the question of how did they agree is, you know, I don't know if there was ever an agreement. I think that it was a, no disrespect to you, but it was a manipulation.
So point accepted, but what were some of the ways that you think the boys were manipulated by the police and prosecutors to give the false stories that they gave, to give the false confessions that they made?
Some of the ways that we show in the piece are that they were without their parents. They were not given food or water. They were asked to repeat the story, and details were inserted into the story through repetition. It's hard to explain, so that's why I wanted to show it.
You mean they were prompted to say things that they added?
The stories were repeated and repeated again and again by both parties, and details were added through repetition. That's one of the ways. Many of the tactics that they described to us are in the piece, and when it comes alive and you actually see it being done and see boys trying to kind of pick up details and also to please who was asking them the questions, all under the kind of false belief that they would be allowed to leave if they cooperated. And that quote-unquote cooperation was, picking up these additional details. I mean, one of the first questions that one of the boys was asked was, what was she wearing? And he didn't know. Kevin Richardson started to describe, I don't know, whatever he thought a white woman would be wearing running through the park. At one point, they didn't even know she was white. They get into these details of talking about trying to sit there and piece together a story and make the person in front of them happy with it. And there were a number of different techniques that were used on them that were ultimately successful.
They lied about each other as part of these coerced confessions. And they named the names of the other young men who were in the five. How did they realize they had lied about each other and had incriminated each other? Because they didn't even all know each other.
Right. Only two of the five knew each other. And it wasn't until four of them were put in a cell together at the end of the interrogation period after they'd all, or four of the five, had been taped, did they find themselves in a room together, and then they began to introduce themselves to one another. So the four boys in that room did not know each other, and they started to talk and started to tell each other what they said and how they'd heard each other's names. And, you know, basically the stories that they told me all separately, we word for word recreate in the film. The part that always kind of destroys me in watching that is these boys were made to be a wolf pack wilding gang in the news at the very same time that they're in a room just meeting each other. And so the revelation of what they had done and incriminating one another through being fed each other's names by police, came to light when they were all together in a cell.
And, you know, after making these coerced confessions, they recanted the confessions, and they never backed down from recanting, even after they were in prison and some of them were offered, you know, parole if they just, you know, took responsibility for the crimes that they committed. They said, we didn't commit those crimes.
That's right. Even Corey Wise, who 13-some years in prison in the worst prisons in New York State, never wavered from the truth, which was that he didn't do it. And lying had gotten him to that place. He believes that lying got him into prison, you know, following the coercion, trying to please, being told that he would be allowed to leave if he said certain things. Those were the regrets that he lives with as a man, you know, decisions that he made, you know, trusting authority figures as a boy. He never intended to lie again because it only got him in, you know, in what he calls death. You know, he says that he died in that prison many times, and that this time now feels like life after death, and sometimes he doesn't even know if he's asleep or awake because it's so surreal. Mm-hmm. And so, they never wavered. They never they never lied again after they all connected. They never went back on their word.
So Linda Fairstein, who is the head of the New York DA's sex crimes unit, is depicted in your film as like bending the truth in order to convict the five. And she, after your series came out, she resigned from several boards of directors, including the board of Vassar, her alma mater. She was dropped by her book publisher and dropped by her agent. Oh, and I should say, Elizabeth Lederer, the lead prosecutor in the case, she resigned after your series from her position as an adjunct faculty member at Columbia University Law School. Do you think that those repercussions were a result of new information that you uncovered, or do you think they were a result of just making what was already known more visible by dramatizing it and getting a big reaction, a big response as a result?
No, I mean, everything that's in the piece is public record and is out there. It had been told before by journalists in books, in articles, in documentary. The story had been told. The power of Netflix to drop it in 190 countries and put it right in people's homes. And, you know, to be able to watch it through dramatization that feels very real and not like news is just the way that some people empathize more with stories like this. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing new that hadn't been said or reported previously.
What was your reaction to Linda Fairstein having, you know, like resigning from Vassar and being dropped by her publisher and her agent?
I don't think I had the reaction that most people thought I would have. I mean, it was just information. It didn't really elicit any kind of big emotion. I mean, I certainly feel like people should be held accountable, and she is. My focus is so much on the men, and my focus is so much on trying to illuminate the real insidious nature of the American criminal justice system that, for me, that piece of it is... it's really just not my focus.
A lot of the final episode is devoted to the story of Corey. And his story is just like particularly heartbreaking. He was charged only because he agreed to accompany his friend who was being picked up by the police on the night of the attack in Central Park. And Corey's name wasn't even on the list of people who they were rounding up. He was just... the cop said to him, why don't you come to the station house with your friend? And so to be loyal to his friend, he came along, ends up making a false confession, ends up getting convicted, and ends up being the only one of the five who's tried as an adult and is sent to adult prisons where he's repeatedly brutalized and assaulted. Also, I think what makes it harder for him is that either he can't read well or he can't read at all. I wasn't quite sure, like, if he could read at all, but that makes it harder for him to figure out what's going on sometimes. And also, he was born or early in childhood had a hearing impairment, so his speech is a little bit slurred. And, like, I think all of those things must have added up to make his years just especially difficult. And I'm wondering, having met all of these men when they were in their 40s, if you feel that he is still suffering a lot because of all of these extra things that he was exposed to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's definitely suffering. He did 13 years. His childhood, his youth was stolen from him.
Right. He did more years than the others.
Yeah, the youth was stolen from him. And so, yeah, I mean, he's definitely affected by all of that and, you know, is trying to make his way through a new life. You know, he always says life after death, life after death. And this is what he's trying to navigate, how to be here on the outside in the world, having gone through a type of darkness that... you know, is really almost impossible to describe. What you see in the film is not all of what he endured.
You mean it was even worse than you depict?
There was more.
There was more beatings?
There was more damage done to him, more darkness, more trauma. And so whenever he's in front of me, I just think he's a miracle. Even when he's not in front of me, I think about him so much. We've become close. He's got a brilliance about him when you sit and talk to him. You know, most people aren't patient enough to sit there and talk to him. But when you do, you get rewards. Like I was speaking with a journalist the other day who had really talked to him for about an hour, and who said that, you know, she blew him away with his insights into human nature and survival and struggle and the criminal justice system. And it just, you know, it requires a patience that most people don't have. And so, you know, I tried to take all of my conversations with Corey, which were so heart expanding for me. You know, he really teaches me a lot in my own life and has helped me a lot in my own life. And to take all of that and somehow put them into the final piece of this 4-part film, this series, he is a real hero in terms of being able to look at someone and say he has battled something greater than most of us ever will and has come out on the other side to tell the story.
I think it was hard for the 5 men after they got out of prison. 4 of them got out before the convictions were vacated. Corey got out after they were vacated. I think it was hard for them to find their place in the world and make a living. There's a lot stacked against you when you spent years in prison and when you were named in this notorious case, even if you're exonerated, even if the convictions are vacated. But when the city finally awarded a settlement, a total for all of them, you know, a combined total of $41 million, was the money helpful? I know the money can't, as they've all pointed out, the money can't buy back the years of their life that were taken away. The money can't buy back the youth that they were robbed of. But it's better to have money than not. So was the money helpful? You know, one of the things Corey did with it was contribute to an innocence project and to working on the subject of false confessions. But can you talk a little bit about the settlement and, you know, ways in which it changed their lives if it did?
Generally, money is helpful when you don't have it. So, you know, Kevin Richardson is working the night shift as a janitor at a convalescent home making minimum wage and unable to pay his rent. Raymond Santana, Antron, you know, these guys are working, you know, what people call manual labor, under the table jobs, you know, where the jobs that you can get when you are formerly incarcerated and people don't care that you've been formerly incarcerated. Those jobs are unfortunately few and far between, or they're working in places, you know, in the jobs that people who have more options don't want to do. So at any point, if anyone gives you any money, your life changes. And certainly, you know, theirs did. It's kind of like the idea that poverty is you with less money. That's not really what poverty is. You know, poverty is being ensnared within a system where at every turn you cannot move. You do not have the resources to climb out of where you live, where you work, your health care, this is the reality for formerly incarcerated people. And so when you put some money on that, you know, it certainly changes some things, but a lot stays the same. And, you know, certainly when you're dealing with the kind of emotional trauma and the family, the violence to the family structure that was done, you know, they've all said they give the money back to just grow up as they were and live and become whatever they were going to be before this happened.
Can you tell us something about their lives now?
They are great people. I love them a lot. You know, they're really, you know, I could cry just thinking about them all. They're good, good guys. You know, 3 of them live in Atlanta. It's funny because, you know, Antron McCray is the first to leave. He goes to Atlanta. He finds this beautiful black oasis in Atlanta where you was, you know, predominantly black town with, you know, lots of people from a lot of different parts of the country. And, you know, there's a certain prosperity that happens in some parts of the city and lots of activity and things to do. And so he goes out there and Raymond comes to visit. Raymond is the person he's closest to. They're really best friends. And Raymond comes to visit, and Raymond's like, yo, what is this? You've got grass in front of your house? Wait, in the back too? Oh no, wait, what? And so shortly thereafter, Raymond picks up and he moves to Atlanta. And then a few months after that, Yusef picks up and moves to Atlanta. And then Kevin lives in New Jersey, just got married. And then Corey is in Harlem, and he has tried to live other places and just loves Harlem. He goes to Al Sharpton's weekly meetings every Saturday in Harlem, community meetings. He's a real part of the community. I've walked the streets with Oprah before. It's similar. It's people love him. They respect him. They look out for him. They give him a lot of love there. And that's why he likes it. It's home. So that's what the five of them are doing, you know, in various places, you know, with their emotional reckoning. But my hope has been, and I've seen it a bit, that the film is been a therapy in some ways. They're able to talk about it. But the main thing is now people know the story. Corey is really, really adamant that people know his story. He said to me early on, it's not the Central Park Five, it's 4+1. I had a different story, and he wanted people to know. And we did everything we could to tell his story. It's a very singular story, and it's different from the other guys. And so just the fact that now when people walk up to him, they know his story, they respect what he went through, I think is, I hope and I pray that it has a positive effect on him and on all of them.
Ava DuVernay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Ava DuVernay produced, directed, and co-wrote the 4-part Netflix series, When They See Us. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Willie Nelson's new country album called Ride Me Back Home. Ken says Nelson sounds vigorous and upbeat on an album about the passage of time and aging.
Time is my friend. The more I reject it, the more that it kicks in. Just enough to keep me on my toes. I say, come on, time. I've beat you before. Come on, time. What have you got for me this time? I'll take your words of wisdom and I'll try to make them right. Hey, it's just me and you again. Come on, time.
Time is my friend, Willie Nelson sings on his new album, Ride Me Back Home. The notion that time is a friend to an 86-year-old man is more than a bit surprising, but Nelson seems to have come to terms with what it means to get old. Deep into the song, he sings, "Time, as you've passed me by, why did you leave these lines on my face? You sure have put me in my place." Anyone else would have set such sentiments to a melancholy tune or a grimly contemplative one. Willie, however, sings his words over a giddy-up prancing beat. He rides both the melody and the lyrics on other songs here as well.
He rode into battle, barebacked and saddled. You took the wound in your side. You pulled the sleds. You pull the wagons. You gave them somewhere to hide. Now they don't need you, and there's no one to feed you, and there's fences where you used to roam. And I wish I could gather up all of your brothers, and you would just ride me back home.
That's Ride Me Back Home, the title song. Nelson makes it another metaphor for a more permanent kind of resting place. You can hear this album as the completion of a trilogy of albums about aging, begun in 2017's God's Problem Child and continued in 2018's Last Man Standing. I think it's the best of the three, as well as the most idiosyncratic. Only Willie Nelson, master interpreter, could coax me into listening to a cover of Billy Joel's Just the Way You Are, a song I would otherwise happily go to my own grave never hearing again. Nelson's other covers include this gorgeous version of a Guy Clark song, My Favorite Picture of You.
My favorite picture of you is the one where you're staring straight into the lens. It's just a Polaroid shot someone took on the spot. No beginning, no end. Just a moment in time that you can't have back. You never left, but your bags were packed. Just in case. My favorite picture of you is bent and it's faded and it's pinned to my wall. Oh, and you were so angry that it's hard to believe that we were lovers at all.
My Favorite Picture of You very much fits into this album's recurring theme, as Nelson comes down hard on the line, just a moment in time that you can't have back. Willie is thinking these days about all the moments he's experienced, the pleasures he's had, the work he's done, and he's savoring the labor he still can do. Addressing all this directly on One More Song to Write.
I got one more song to write. I've got one more bridge to burn. I've got one more endless night. One more lesson to be learned. One more hill to climb. And it's somewhere in my mind. I'll know it when it's right. I've got one more song to write.
This album, Ride Me Back Home, certainly doesn't sound like Willie Nelson's final statement about anything. It's a lively, restless collection that contains solid new material and a keen sense of self-scholarship. Perhaps only Willie himself remembered Stay Away from Lonely Places, a song tucked deep into a 1972 album, but he breathes new life into it here. His voice and his spirit remain strong and supple. Interested in mortality, but never its slave, Willie Nelson may be preparing to greet death, but if so, he's doing it in the most jaunty way possible.
Ken Tucker reviewed Willie Nelson's new album, Ride Me Back Home. Coming up, we hear from Bill Hader. He co-created and stars in HBO's dark comedy series Barry. Before that, he was a performer and writer on Saturday Night Live. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Bill Hader became famous as a performer and writer on Saturday Night Live for his original characters like Stefan and his impressions of people like Vincent Price. Now Hader stars in the HBO series Barry, which he co-created, co-writes, and he serves as one of the directors. Seasons 1 and 2 are available on demand, and the show's been renewed for a third. Last year, after season 1, Hader won the Emmy for Best Lead Actor in a Comedy Series. Hader plays Barry, a Marine who's suffered from depression and PTSD ever since returning from Afghanistan. After feeling useless back home, he became a hitman, doing what he knew he was good at, shooting people. One hit he's assigned is in L.A., where his job is to kill a young man who's having an affair with the wife of the crime boss. As Barry pursues his target, who's a personal trainer and acting student, Barry sits in on the acting class, ends up doing a scene, and thinks maybe he can transform his life by becoming an actor. In this scene from season 1, Barry asks the acting teacher, Gene Cousineau, if he can join the class. Cousineau is played by Henry Winkler, who also won an Emmy last year for his performance in Barry.
Hey, Ms. Cousineau, I was wondering, do you think I was good enough to be in your class?
No, Barry, I don't. What you did was dog shit. I mean, really, really awful. Dumb acting, I call it. Do you know why? Because acting is truth, and I saw no truth. So here's my advice to you. You go back to whatever nook of the world you call home, and you do whatever it is you're good at. Because this is not it.
You want to know what I'm good at? I'm good at killing people. Yeah, when I got back from Afghanistan, I was really depressed. You know, like I didn't leave my house for months. And this friend of my dad's, he's like an uncle to me. He helped me out and he gave me a purpose. He told me that what I was good at over there could be useful here. And it's a job, you know? Like, the money's good. And these people I take out, like, they're bad people. But lately, you know, I'm not sleeping, and that depressed feeling's back, you know? Like, I know there's more to me than that. But maybe, I don't know. Maybe there's not. Maybe this is all I'm good at. I don't know. Anyway, forget it. Sorry to bother you.
What's that from?
What?
Are you telling me that was an improvisation? Huh. Interesting. The story's nonsense, but there's something to work with. My class is not cheap.
Well, it's not a problem.
You're paying cash?
Yeah.
You're paying advance?
I can do that.
Next class tomorrow, 2 p.m. We start on time.
Absolutely.
What's your last name again?
Block. Barry Block.
You pay in advance?
Yeah, no, I know.
Jean M. Cousineau. I look forward to this journey.
Bill Hader, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the series. Hi. Well, that clip kind of summarizes part of what the first season was about. Barry knowing that he's a good hitman, but truly wanting a different life. And he has trouble speaking the truth on stage, but when he speaks it off stage, like he did in that scene, people don't always believe him because it seems so preposterous. And that's a kind of constant thing in the series, that when people like act the truth, people don't necessarily want to hear it. When they act the more, you know, stage version of the truth, that's a distortion of the truth, people like give them accolades.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I always find that's true, especially in art in general. It's the kind of harsh reality of something. You know, I think you could kind of a cynical way, well, it doesn't really sell and things like that, which might be true. But I think also what we in the writer's room when we talked about it was, you know, Alec Berg, who co-created the show with me, we realized, you know, I think people just don't like hearing about it. You know, people like a nice story.
It's a bummer.
It's a bummer. Yeah, that was the thing we kept saying. It was like, oh, that was a bummer. Yeah, that was like, it was a real bummer. And so, yeah, a lot of times in season two, the whole Henry Winkler's character, the acting coach, Jean Cousineau, makes them do a truth exercise, talk about your deepest truth of who made you who you are. And to be honest and real, that makes you an artist. And how, one, that's really hard to do, and two, do people even really want to hear that?
Yeah. How did the idea of a hitman who wants to be an actor get started? Like, what was the germ of that idea?
Alec Berg and I were kind of put together by our mutual agent. This is back in 2014.
And, oh, so you weren't buddies? Like, somebody, like,
I knew him. Yeah, someone played matchmaker, and it worked. Yeah, but we're in the same comedy circles and stuff like that, but we thought, oh, well, let's go and I had this deal at HBO and to make a show, but I didn't know what the show was. And then we would sit and we talked about one idea for a while, and we realized that, you know, it was kind of an idea that didn't have any stakes to it. We realized, like, we had a great pilot episode, and then when we thought of what would be other episodes, we didn't have anything.
What was that first idea?
It was essentially me playing someone I grew up with in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was kind of the character. I was in a movie called Hot Rod, and the character I played in Hot Rod, it was kind of like a version of that guy, and it was very much like a day in the life kind of meandering thing of this kind of wayward guy in Oklahoma, and it just was boring. You know, like, I just was like, I can't really get into this. I mean, we have bits, there's comedy bits, but where's the emotion? Where's the story? And really, where are the stakes to it, you know? And so we kind of had this breakfast. I remember a bummer breakfast, right? Where we both were like, kind of separately went, I don't think this idea works. It's kind of, it doesn't really hold water. And I go, it should be stakes. And I remember he said, oh, you know, life and death. You know, that's the ultimate, right? Death, that, you know. And I just said, well, what if I was a hitman? And he went, ugh, I hate hitmen. And he said, hitman's like dog catcher. There's more in television and movies than there are in real life, you know. There's not hitman. What is that, you know? I go, but what if it was me, you know? And it's not a guy. It's not, you know, the kind of cool guy with two guns in his hands with the long tie. Like, what if we... You know, the black tie and the suit. You know, what if we made it real? And we talked about that, and then I'm not joking. We suddenly both got fixated on the idea of him being an actor. I don't know why. I don't know where it came from. We just both started talking about him taking an acting class, and I remember specifically Alec going, "Oh, Hitman wants to be an actor. That's funny. That's good." You know, and then we started seeing these interesting correlations of the conflict within that of, you know, a hitman wants to be in the shadows, but an actor wants to be in the spotlight. A hitman wants to be anonymous, but actors want to be known. A hitman wants to suppress his emotions, where an actor wants to constantly be, you know, harnessing their emotions and all these things. So it was a funny... It just seemed, you know, the acorn, the seed of the idea could... You know, give us a tree that, you know, give us a lot of interesting stories and different branches and places to go off to.
So I want to get back to the idea of, you know, acting as truth telling, as telling some like emotional truth and drawing that emotional truth from deep within yourself. So did you ever go through that kind of soul searching as an actor? You didn't go to acting school, right?
No, I went to Second City, LA. I learned I just improv, but I never took an acting class really like the one that's in the show.
So, like, what kinds of experiences or secondhand experiences are you basing that class on? Where it's all about like getting to the emotional truth, and sometimes like the acting teacher will emotionally push one of the students to the edge to get them to the point where they're ready to like be emotionally naked on stage.
Well, we went to acting classes and audited them and sat in the back.
Oh, as research for the series?
As research for the series, yeah. And so it was weird. Alec kind of looked at me weird. I'm like, we got to go, you know, do some research on acting classes. And he was like, Bill, you're an actor. I go, I know, but I don't know these classes. And then at some point, Alec just had to go because some of the people would recognize me and it would be weird and what is he doing here? And so Alec would kind of go by himself. But we saw in the pilot, there's a scene between Henry Winkler, plays Cousineau, and Sarah Goldberg, plays Sally Reed.
One of the students.
One of the students where he berates her into getting the right emotional response. And Alec saw that.
Oh, really?
He remembered calling me saying, I just saw this thing where this guy just went after this actress hard to get her to this place. And then she started doing the scene and she was really, you know, crying and so thankful for him for getting her there, you know, and all this stuff. And he said it was very strange.
The first time I interviewed you, I didn't know about this, but apparently when you were on Saturday Night Live, you had a lot of... anxiety about performing live and even had like a panic attack, I think, while the show was on, while you were...
Yeah, on the air, I had a panic attack.
While you were doing a bit playing Julian Assange.
Yeah, I was playing Julian Assange. I had a panic attack. It was fun.
can you describe what happened then?
Yeah, I was doing a Julian Assange. It was Jeff Bridges hosting, and I don't know what happened, but I suddenly went, I can't breathe. It just felt like I was dying. That's the only way I could describe it. The panic. I think it was a bit of exhaustion and also I'm a very naturally anxious person. You know, and in some ways it's good because when I'm directing a thing, I'm 8 steps ahead of things and I'm trying to make sure things are in order and things like that. You know, we talk about the things that we wish we could change in ourselves. And, you know, I was very, very anxious, and it could kind of make me slightly isolated or not being in the moment. And on Saturday Night Live, I felt like the majority of my time there, especially in the first half of it at least, I wasn't in the moment. I was very, very, very nervous. Heart palpitations, sweating, I would get dizzy. I remember once it got to the point where I became completely convinced that either a piece of equipment was going to fall on me or that someone was going to storm the stage, that someone in the audience was going to run up on stage.
Well, that seemed like unusual things to worry about.
Yeah, it got crazy.
I thought you'd
be
worrying about, you know, like, I'm going to forget my lines. I didn't know, and you forget your lines and things.
It went from that to that. So once I started getting into these other things, then I started doing like TM and, you know, you take, you know, medication, you go to a therapist, you know, exercise, changing my diet. I mean, all these things to try to get this under control. And it's just acknowledging it, you know. You just kind of go, that's not happening. Relax. But I think it got to a really bad place. And I think in Barry, it's not so much the anxiety of it. It was more of this idea that I was naturally good at impressions. And I was telling Alec Berg this when we were just starting writing. I go, you know, I was always good at impressions, but what I always wanted to do was write and direct. I moved out to Los Angeles 20 years ago to be a writer-director, and I was a production assistant, and I did all these things. And, you know, was a crew guy forever, and then kind of happened, you know, in a fluky way, got on Saturday Night Live. You know, Megan Mullally saw me in a show, I got on Saturday Night Live, and I was not prepared for it. And I was saying it's so ironic that all the things I was writing and directing were never really, all the short films I made were never very that good, and the scripts I were writing they were not good. I had a lot to learn, but I could kind of just do impressions. And the irony was that the show I did the impressions on, it was like slowly destroying me because of the anxiety of having to perform in front of a bunch of, in front of the nation. You know, I hosted a year ago and I was a wreck. And I told Alec this and he went, I think that's the show. It's about a guy who thinks, you know, the thing he's naturally good at is destroying him, but the thing he wants to do, he's not very good at. You know? And he goes, well, that's an emotion. You understand. We can write that.
You know, it's funny when someone like me is at home watching Saturday Night Live, watching the performers do really funny things. You know, like, I'm thinking, like, God, they're so lucky. They're having such a good time doing this. You can see what a good time they're having doing this. And you're telling me that, like, it was not, the performance part was not enjoyable. It was kind of terrifying.
Yeah, I think that's, well, towards the end, I started laughing a lot in sketches, especially when I would play the Stefan character and things like that. And that was, it was funny, but it was also releasing a lot of that anxiety and kind of going, well, what's the worst that can happen right now? Oh, wow. The phone just went off in here. It's not my cell phone. It's the phone in the...
Wow, how did that happen?
I don't know. Maybe they're calling me to get me out of here.
Yeah, I think that's it, Bill.
Yeah, that's it. And it's like, it's Lauren Michaels. Shut up. No, all right, I'll start over. But actually, I say that joke about Lauren, but actually, he didn't mind the laughing because he said if you were laughing about something that wasn't funny, I would be annoyed with you, but what you're saying is so ridiculous and funny. It's enjoyable to watch. But I think the reason John Mulaney would do that, he would put things on the cue cards that I hadn't seen, or he would tell me about it as I was walking
out. This is when you were
out.
Playing Stefan.
Stefan, yeah, mm-hmm. is that I was so wound tight beforehand. And what I always wanted to do with my hands when I was in doing sketch was what Stefan does, was just cover my face. I always wanted to put my head down. So if you go back and watch me, my hands are constantly wanting to cover my face, especially on Update. I remember playing John Malkovich, and my hand was in front of my face the entire time. And Doug Abels, who ran Update, came up and was like, dude, you got to put your hand down. I can't see your face. Why is your hand up in front of your face? And I'm like, because I'm terrified. I'm having a panic attack. I mean, not a panic attack, but I just would get so charged up. I would get so anxious about going out. So,
did everyone on their show know about that?
Some people knew about it. I think I'll be totally honest. I don't blame them. I think some people thought I was just being dramatic, which I don't blame them, because it was this kind of before everything. I think people got a bit like, all right, Bill, relax, you know, not talking a lot, staring down at my feet. I would just get, or towards the end, I would, try to just go, oh, there it is. You know, that's your friend. Don't fight it. Just go, okay, there's the anxious feeling. Like, let's just let it attack you, but don't fight it, because when you fight it, it gets worse.
Bill Hader, it's been great to talk with you again. I regret that our time is up. I look forward to season 3 of Barry. Thank you so much for coming back to Fresh
Thank
Air.
Thank you. This is a huge honor.
Bill Hader is a former Saturday Night Live writer and cast member. He now stars in the HBO comedy series Barry, which he co-created. Seasons 1 and 2 are available on demand, and the show's been renewed for a third season. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly CV Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.